Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, King Arthur at kingarthurflower.com, Colavita at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Folks, welcome. Mike Colomeco here. Mike Colomeco's Food Talk live from Morgantown. Yes, that's what they refer to this area of Bushwick as. Morgantown, because that's my stop on the subway. And I got to the studio early today and wandered around the neighborhood to kill time because my day was timed that way. Tons of great, if you're a fan of really good graffiti, come out here, man. We have some of the best graffiti I've seen in the city that looks like whoever owns the properties has let taggers come in and kind of curated it. So, nice walk. Besides Roberta's being an interesting restaurant and there being sort of food options out here, the graffiti might be just worth a trip all by itself. Anyway, we've got a good show coming up today. We've got a couple of guests. My first guest is Tad Carducci, one of the co-founders of Tippling Brothers. We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. I think we're going to talk about Amaro at some point, specifically Averna, because it's one of these kind of obscure Italian digestives, or whatever you want to call them, that's just become so popular today it cracks me up, because as an Italian kid growing up, I saw these bottles, these iconic label designs in my parents and relatives and bars and houses and restaurants that we all grew up in West Philly, and now it's like the world's discovered tomorrow. We're also going to back it up and talk a little about cocktail culture in general in the country. Thanks. You could just shut the thing off. Don't worry about it. It's my phone. You're not supposed to have phones in radio studios, but I do. I was going to shout out to my boys at Rosette. Great restaurant. I finally got to. It's in my neighborhood on East Broadway. Another one of these restaurants that's opening up, not just south of Delancey, but block south of Delancey, in that little quadrant that's kind of Chinatown East meets the Lower East Side, Division Street, Canal Street. So right now you've got Skal down there that's great, Fung Tu that's interesting, and I have to say, Rosette, my first visit was last week, and I really, really had a great time. Really cool food, big space, and surprisingly, I was surprised at how busy they were for whatever the night of the week it was. Rainy kind of a night, and the house was almost full when I was there, and a great dinner yesterday with Sunny Boy at a restaurant, one of the restaurants I filmed at one of the troubles with my show on PBS, which is, if you've never watched Mike Colomeco's Real Food, go to channel13.org and you can watch any of the shows from this season on demand on your handheld. But I do 23, 24 years, so I'm always going out to eat at new places, and I don't really get to go to the places I love because that's not work. That's just, you know, an indulgence to go to a place that you've already been. Yet, I have to do it because I love the places. So I went to Le Philosophe, which is a really cool, old school, classic French place run by Americans, and the front of the house is a little different, but the owner's actually was born and raised in Switzerland. The chef's an American kid, and it's just great class kind of French food I grew up cooking and eating, kind of stuff that was really popular. You would have seen on menus in the 70s and 80s, you know, Tornados Rossini and Frog Legs, but kind of modernized, beautiful. Wine list is insane. It's on Bond Street, beautiful street. If you've never been to Le Philosophe, I can't recommend it enough, and the wine list in and of itself is cool. Anyway, Tad, thanks for coming out to Bushwick. Let's get started.
Cool. It's my pleasure.
So let's talk about just cocktail culture, because you've kind of been in this mix in New York. If I go back a decade and a half, as I mentioned to you before we went on, one of my signature drinks has always been the Negroni, and I can't tell you how many times I would be at a restaurant or a bar and order one, and they'd say, oh, we don't have something, chartreuse or something, and I'm like, you have Campari, you've got good gin, you've got Martini and Rossi, one part each, over ice, right. Garnish. So, I mean, the bartending scene, I mean, well, you talk about, I mean, because you've been ringside, and you were kind of there when it popped. When did it start to pop? How? Why?
I would say, you know, at this point, we're probably looking at about a decade or so since the inception of hey, let's start using fresh juice in our cocktails. Let's start making real Manhattans and variations on different things. And, you know, the Negroni is a funny one because now it's everywhere. I mean, so de rigueur. Everywhere you go has a Negroni or their own proprietary Negroni variation or something like that. Sometimes that have absolutely nothing to do with the original, and that always burns my ass. But, you know, I would say probably within the last 5 or 6 years is when people really started taking ownership and kind of getting back to the sense of bartending really being a craft, and thinking about the technique, the hospitality and everything, but also the end product, the cocktail being of paramount importance, you know, and the history as well.
And incredible ingredients. I mean, so, I mean, I don't know where what went, like Death and Company and those guys, and it's PDT and yeah. Sort of the early round of the New York super cool cocktail lounges where, I mean, everything from the ICE program. Yeah. I mean, we used to think of it was, it used to be just like you were a bartender and that was it. And someone ordered stuff and you went to your Scotsman, filled it up with that shit ice, and that's what you made drinks with. And, you know, now, like, I'm going to places and they've got a block of ice and they're hand chunking these ginormous cubes, pre-cooling the drinks, which is the right way to do it. Get it down to, you know, 20% of the water's now in it. You got the temperature you want. Pour it over a ginormous rock, and it just holds it.
Right. Just the fact that you put two words together, ice program. I mean, people now have ice programs, and they have bitters programs, and they have all these different things. I mean, it's amazing. When I first started leafing through cocktail books 10, 15 years ago, I remember seeing all these different types of bitters and knowing full well that the only bitters I could ever get my hands on had a yellow cap and they were called Angostura. And most bars had a bottle tucked somewhere underneath the sink or something like that, never used it. Now we're back to, there are probably 50, 55 commercially available brands of bitters, and it's so cool. And places are house made, quote unquote, house making lots of bitters and liqueurs and tinctures and things. I mean, it's kind of gone almost off the wall at this point, but in a good way, in a fun way.
Well, back to the Campari thing. So we're talking about Negronis, and you could, and then, you know, so a while back, I ended up writing the cover story for Edible Manhattan, and that was a Negroni. It was on the Negroni and my love affair with it. And now it's like watching your sort of, you know, your forgotten son become the star of the parade. Well, so I go to Restaurant Lincoln, and they have a Negroni program.
Right.
I was at Rouge Tomat a couple of weeks ago, where I love the Sommelier Pascaline, and I ordered a Negroni there, and that, you know, again, this wasn't. Here's the story. So they use Campari, they use whatever gin you want as the choice. They use a really interesting vermouth that's based on Nebbiolo wine from the Barolo region. Right. They pre-mix it and then they cask age that mixture for like 2 months in oak, and then that's their Negroni. I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, barrel aging is like the new. It's probably the most prevalent kind of mixological trend in existence right now. And it's funny, it was started by a buddy of mine on the West Coast who chuckles every time he sees one. Now, he was really just, you know, it was just
playing,
kind of just for fun.
Right.
And now, you know, I'll do work for a major hotel company, and they're like, we want to endeavor into a barrel-aged cocktail program. Again, program. You know, everything has, you put program at the end of something, that means it's got to be cool.
Yeah.
And he just cracks up and laughs.
Put artisan in the front, program on the back, exactly. And we've got it. Now, all right, now let's talk about a Vernick.
Yeah.
This is so, Italian kid, grew up in West Philly, working class family, Sunday dinner, always at grandmom's house. My grandpa, somebody made wine in the neighborhood. It was called Moroni wine. The guy's name was Moroni. It was in green gallon jugs. And kind of remind, now that I'm older and I go back on flavor memories, it kind of reminds me of sort of Southern Italian or Sangiovese blends. The drinks at the table, they weren't big drinkers, so cocktail culture sort of didn't exist. You drank wine with dinner. And then after dinner was the usual Galliano, Strega. But there was always these mysterious bitters, and Averna was one of them. What are they as a category?
Sure.
What's the story behind them? And then in terms of like fortified wines, whatever you want to call them, how were they made?
Sure.
Give us this 101.
Before I do that, let me, I grew up in a very similar situation. It's a very similar heritage and background. And we would, on Sundays, kind of after the first couple of courses were served, my grandfather would grab everybody and all the kids, you know, whether you were 8 or 10 or 17, and take us into the kitchen, and he would have whatever mismatched glassware that was in the house lined up on the counter with you know, a half shot of Averna and some either orange juice or orange soda, whichever was there. Line them all up, and it was very hush hush. We thought we were pulling one over on our parents. We thought my grandfather was the coolest guy on the face of the earth, and we'd all take our drink, and my grandfather would joke around with us, and we thought, my God, this is amazing. And then all of us within 15-20 minutes passed out asleep on the floor, and then the adults could commence to drinking grappa and smoking cigars and swearing, and you know, he was a brilliant man, and I've learned this. So now my son, who's I won't get into that.
That's right. Authorities might be listening.
Amaro in general is a category. I mean, the category by definition, Amaro means bitter in Italian, and it's been around for probably 150, 160 years. Most of the recipes that you see commercially available are from the 1850s, 1860s. There was probably some sort of monastic tradition that somebody paid very good money to a monastic order to take a recipe and bottle that, and that's kind of how this tradition of famous Amaro from Italy or Amari from Italy was born. The category really goes back probably closer to about 1,000 years when philosophers and doctors and botanists and things were studying distillation and the effects of beverage alcohol on the preservation of botanical things. So herbs and roots and fruit peels and barks and spices and all of that.
Which, by the way, happens to be a laundry list of the ingredients that are probably in a lot of these Amaros.
In all of them.
Vegetables, root peels, barks, herbs, burnt orange, who knows?
That's exactly what they... these are comprised of. Most... When we say Amaro, we typically think of products that are distilled, that are based either on grain or grape alcohol, or sometimes sugar beet alcohol. To the Italians, it's funny that part of it doesn't matter as much. To American mixologists, we must know the base spirit. We must know, and most of the Italians are like, "How, you know, can you tell the difference?"
Right? Because inform in the finished product? Is there any way you're going to tell?
And the
answer is no.
No. The answer is generally no.
Start with a base alcohol. Period.
Yes.
Like a grain neutral, whatever.
Correct. And then you know anywhere between 10 and 50 or 60 ingredients will go in, most of which are secret. There's a lot of intrigue, a lot of mystery that surrounds a lot of these brands, and it's part of the fun. It's part of the allure of the whole thing. They'll get steeped into the alcohol for a few weeks, usually. Then the product is either sweetened and or colored with caramel.
Right.
For us, that's a huge no-no. We think Coca-Cola, we think, you know, chemical byproducts and things like that. To the Italians, it's a very, very natural process. I mean, it's burned sugar, and there's craft in the making of that caramel too. And so that'll sweeten and color color the Amaro.
For the infusion, is there any heat or is it cold infusion?
It depends. Sometimes there is. There are a couple of products that will take all of the different botanicals, pulverize them, and then toast them over an open fire, or pulverize them and add some water and boil the hell out of them over
to make
an open fire.
Distillation.
Yeah, and you'll get a very distinct smokiness, almost like a scotch or like a mezcal or something like that. Most times it's just a kind of a maceration or a slow, just ambient temperature infusion, and they'll either be separate components. Like all the fruit peels will be in one, all of the herbs and spices will be in one, and then the bittering ingredients will be in another. But sometimes they just throw the whole lot together and come what may, you know.
And then stored in stainless or oak? I mean, it must have changed over the years. Obviously, it was oak in the old days.
Right.
Or whatever they had as a vessel.
I would say the bulk of them are now rested probably in stainless for a month, maybe 2 months. Some of them are aged in usually used pretty big, like Slovenian oak barrels or things like that. And that's... it's not so much to impart oak flavor, but to just kind of soften the spirit and mellow it out. But it's pretty cool when you go to some of the... some of the facilities and see
these ginormous
huge old barrels.
We were just in port, and some of the ports, I forget which one it was, maybe the Tawny's, are aged in these just, I mean,
yeah,
three times the size of the room we're in.
Yep.
Just huge. These really, and they're the big houses like Sandman and Graham's, they have their own coopers on staff in-house that are building them, repairing them. If there's leaks, they put them. I mean, it was insane to see these rooms. You're like, whoa. And I forget, they throw these numbers at you, how many thousands of, hundreds of thousands or tens of liters are in this thing. It's nuts.
You know, it's funny. I was at the Middleton Distillery in Ireland last year, and we were watching the coopers. And to me, you know, I'm a big hands-on guy, you know, craft, in other words. You know, one of my secret passions was, you know, if I had it to do over again, I probably would have been a barrel maker or a carpenter or something, because it's just amazing to watch these guys. But they were telling us that it's very much a dying art or a dying craft, and there are not enough generations coming up, or not enough interest in this kind of this beautiful way to make a living. So they're kind of really, really scrambling, and that's from whiskey distilleries to wineries to fortified wine as well.
Because the wineries need new oak. Some of them are using old, and then some of, like the port guys are saying, they'll share barrels with the whiskey guys.
Yeah, sure.
So, all right, have you been to the Averna factory?
I have, yeah. It's in
where is it?
It's in Caltanissetta, in the smack in the middle of the island of Sicily. And it's a really cool facility. The Averna has been owned by the same family since around 1868, and it's still run by the family, and they're just, you know, salt of the earth people. And it's very cool to see, you know, the kind of blend of tradition and modernity that goes on there. It's really neat. And they too are very, you know, their lips are they're tight-lipped when it comes to what's in the product. I went over there probably 5 or 6 years ago at this point. I was working with a brand, and, you know, as I said, American bartenders need to know everything. You know, we feel we're entitled, you know. And I went over there, and I'm like, okay, so exactly what's in it? Oh, no. I saw it. I cannot tell you this. Well, you know, can you give me an idea? So we go on this little tour, and there's the room. There's the room they show you with the burlap sacks of, you know, these abundanza, like these bountiful orange peels falling out and all this stuff. And you know that's the showroom. And then around the corner is the real room. So as we were passing by this door, the group kept going, and I took a couple steps back and tried to poke my head in, and I feel this hand on my shoulder and pulls me back. And I'm like, listen, I'm just trying to help you sell this to American bartenders. I need to know. And I got a finger wagged in my face. Some things are not for you to know.
Uh-huh.
Like, okay, if you don't want to sell it, that's fine. But that's the whole mystique and the tradition. And it's really pretty cool because I think it forces us to use our flavor memories and our palates to really try to figure out what's inside the stuff.
How would you... Let's talk about drinking it. So, again, back in the day, Grandpa, it would be at room temperature on the table in some kind of a small, again, like you were describing, the Italians have all these weirdo-shaped glasses, and it would be in one of those neat, you know, one or two after dinner was the kind of thing. Is that the best way? Should it be chilled? What do you think?
You know, for me, Averna specifically, I like it with a slight chill on it because it is... as Amaro goes, or as Amari go, it's big. It's very
it's heavy,
rich.
It's got a lot of weight to it.
It does. And it's on the sweeter side, you know, kind of medium level of bitterness. And it's fairly sweet. So to drink it neat, it's intense. If you cut it with, if you either chill it or cut it with an ice cube or two, and maybe an orange peel or a slice of orange, I think it's perfect. It's really delicious that way. If you're drinking it after dinner, it's also a killer cocktail ingredient, and we've had a ton of success working with it around the country, in everything from, you know, just simple riffs on a Manhattan to, you know, cocktails where you're using 2 ounces of Averna as the base, and really works well.
So you're still involved to some extent, but I remember just as I was decamping my old 10-year residence in the West Village on Abington Square. I was a big fan of the Chelsea Market, Lobster Place, great seafood store, Jake Dixon, great meat upstairs, Amy's Bread. It was one-stop shopping for me for dinner.
Sure.
There was a bar that opened downstairs that you guys had something to do with called?
The Tippler.
And because that's the Tippler Brothers, is sort of So you had a cocktail there. Talk about that you just kind of riffed on, that you were surprised at how popular that became.
Yeah, we kind of based on what I was talking about with my grandfather, the drink was called the Top Cat, or in Italian, the Gatto Migliore. And that's all the Italian I speak, by the way. But it was just a very simple riff on either what we drank as kids, or something that's very popular kind of in the South on the Amalfi Coast with younger generation, especially in the summertime at the beach. And it'll just be Averna or some other Amaro with Fanta Orange or San Pellegrino or Ranciata or something like that. So we did this drink.
It's like orange soda. It's like orange. Exactly. Their version of, exactly. Not as gross, but it's like orange crush kind of whatever.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Fizzy, sweet, orangey. Orangina in the South of France.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So what we did is take some crushed ice, a couple of ounces of Averna, muddled a fresh strawberry, squeeze of half a lemon, and then fill it up with Fanta orange soda. And this drink crushes it, or crushed it, I should say, at the Tippler. We would sell 1,000 to 1,500 of them a month. And it was so drinkable and so enjoyable and just lighthearted and fun that it became a very much a word of mouth favorite at the bar. And most people, at least for their first several, had no idea what they were drinking. They had no idea what Averna was. They saw the name, but they, you know, ultimately they got so into the drink that they finally, you know, walked up to the bar to query the bartender as to what the stuff actually is or was. And of course, you know, they either got the short version or the long version of, you know, how much time do you have, of what everyone actually, what it is. And so that was a win-win for us, because we made a great drink that was not serious and a lot of fun and tasted great. But then we also got to kind of lure people into what Amaro is and start them off gently and watch them move to Fernet Branca at some point.
I was thinking, I just wrote down, I was writing down Fernet Branca, because that's another one that's like, so funny how sort of industry insiders, you know, shots of Fernet, you're always, what is that stuff?
Again, yeah.
Just another version of this. Forget the mint ones. I'm not crazy about that. But the classic old school Fernet, what's the flavor profile?
Right. Fernet,
you would describe that.
Sure. Well, Fernet is funny because it's got its own kind of subculture when it comes to Amaro. And it's very much a bartender thing, especially in San Francisco and Boston. It's huge in Argentina. It's huge
in Argentina. Before dinner, after dinner, during dinner.
Fernet and Coke.
Yeah.
And anywhere you find, what's interesting is anywhere you find either Argentinian cultures or sometimes Portuguese cultures and things like that, they'll drink a lot of Fernet. Fernet is kind of a subcategory of Amaro, and generally you think of Fernet as anything that's bracingly bitter, really astringent, high alcohol. Usually it's almost 80%, if not, or excuse me, almost 80 proof, if not 80 proof.
Upon drinking way too much one night, thinking it was 40 or something, like, you know, like regular.
New.
I remember, like, why am I so hungover? Yeah. And then I wanted to go spin that bottle, and I'm like, it's like drinking whiskey.
Yeah, if you get banged up on Fernet,
you're dinged.
You're dinged, but your stomach feels great. You know, digestively, you're in great shape.
You just can't think or breathe.
Yeah, no. The flavor profile, most Branca being the benchmark Fernet, saffron is a big component. Eucalyptus or mint or like a menthol kind of thing is very prevalent. Aloe is a very interesting ingredient. Aloe, and just, you know, the aloe that we know, the big fronds that looks like a cactus, contains aloin, and it's one of the most bitter ingredients in the world. And it doesn't impart any flavor, but it's incredibly, incredibly bitter. So that's usually in Fernets. As well as myrrh and some other, you know, these things you hear about in the Bible, or the three wise men were carrying
frankincense, myrrh, and whatever the hell the other one was.
Yeah, and Fernet Branca.
Fernet Branca.
So it's a total phenomenon, and it's another. I was very lucky to do an event and have lunch with Count Niccolo Branca, who he's an actual, well, he's a count here. So, you know, at least his papers say he's a count. No, I think he is. And he was in New York, and a bunch of bartenders cornered him and had lunch. And we burning question, what is Fernet? Please explain to us exactly what Fernet is, because we need to know. There is no real definition anywhere. And I'll do the same Italian accent I did before. He said, Fernet is Branca. Branca is Fernet. You know, absolutely not answering our question at all. But, you know, that's what he had to say.
That's the answer, pal.
Yeah.
You're not gonna
you know what? I'm not going to stop buying it just because, you know, I'm a fan of it too. But it's certainly in moderation.
Yeah, that's the trouble. It's damn good, and you want another glass all the time. So how would you describe, then, to listeners, how would you describe the flavor profile of Averna? Because some of these, there's that one in that Monte, whatever, that green
Montenegro,
kind of,
yeah.
Right, Montenegro that's very burnt orange. And again, that's sure, kind of in my wheelhouse, a guy that drinks Negronis all the time.
Right.
If you like Campari, burnt orange is like the driver. How would you describe Averna? Because you were just sort of breaking Fernet down for us.
Right. Averna is definitely, if Fernet is at, you know, the left end of the spectrum, Averna is far right. With Montenegro and Maletti and some other brands like that probably being kind of right in the middle. Averna is definitely rich, sweet, sweeter, less bitter than is Fernet. Roasted sort of flavors, kind of chocolate, burnt orange, definitely burnt orange, but kind of candied orange. Ginger, there's a like a sagey rosemary kind of thing as well. Bitterness coming from gentian root and cinchona, so you're getting really like very astringently kind of bitter things. But there's also this sort of cola spice thing that goes on. When I teach about Amaro, we teach about body and kind of the spectrum of like you would with wine, how some people break it down with milk, you know, from skim milk to cream. But I also there's also very much a regionality or a global aspect to a lot of these different brands. And I think before we went on air, we were talking about a woman who was, you know, making one in her little in her bathtub.
I stopped at Lou DiPaolo's wine store in Grand Street, Enoteca DiPaolo, that Lou built right behind his great cheese store. And it's stocked with all Italian wines and Italian liquors and grappas and Amaros. And his selection of Amaros, dope. And there's one that it's like a handmade label, you know, typical artsy Italian small batch thing. And as Lou described it to me, it's, you know, these women up in the hills outside of Florence over a copper kettle.
Yeah.
It's like small batch, finishing it off with honey. I mean, that's the stuff.
Yeah. And what they're doing is grabbing anything that is botanical, excuse me, nature and is aromatic, and including some bitter ingredients, all of which probably grow within, you know, a kilometer of their house or wherever it is they make the stuff. And they're throwing that in there. And that's very much a regional style, especially in the mountains, anywhere in the north. It's everything that you walk up the mountain, you take a basket, and whatever you bring back goes in. Averna is very different. It's from Sicily. Sicily was the, you know, was just like the shipping port of the world for a while. Everybody and their brother and sister
everybody
came
passed through, ran at the Spanish, the Moors. Italy's got Sicily has just so much mixed blood and culture.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So if you think about all those influences coming from all over the world, from Southeast Asia, from the Near East, from probably the New World at some point before we knew it, and all the, you know, they're bringing ingredients in from absolutely everywhere, and those are in this bottle, and it's pretty cool because it represents kind of the history of the spice route. There's ginger in there, there's galangal in there, there's all kinds of funky stuff that's not growing in Sicily, growing in Italy,
right?
But then there are things that absolutely are growing in Sicily and in the mainland and in Italy as well. So it's really got a very global kind of palette when you think of Amaro, and that's what makes it really cool for cocktails, because you can a budding mixologist or a seasoned mixologist can take almost any other natural flavor, you know, something that grows out of the ground, throw it into the cocktail, and it's going to either be augmented by the that flavor in Averna or vice versa, where it's going to pull.
Talk about mixing in a minute, Evan. Do we have the next guest in the house yet? They're not in yet. Okay, maybe I'll check my phone. Let's take a quick spot, and we'll be back with more of a conversation about. We have to figure out why people are drinking bitters, which is going to be my next question coming out of the break. Quick spot from people that make this show possible, and we'll be back with more. Let me see. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What are the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks, Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you spot by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Yeah, man. Hey, all right, there we go. Here we are, live radio. We're live again.
Cool.
So cool. Thanks for coming out again. So one of the things I wanted to touch on before we call it quits was... how do you explain the fascination? I mean, the American palate's changed so much in terms of what we're enjoying in terms of wines and spirits and what we're tolerating. And to drink these Amaros, you really have to have a tolerance for bitter. And why? Where has the American palate, how did it move into that space?
You know, it's amazing. And I think, you know, and I look back at the last several years of my career, you know, guys like us and people who have been trying to drive this sort of gastronomical train forward for the last however many years. It's finally working. I mean, it's really working, and it's working not only with the generation that's, you know, 30, 35 plus, but with the 25-year-olds and with kids who you would who should, right. for all intents and purposes, still be drinking Jägermeister, and right. nothing against Jäger. I love it, and it helps put a roof over my head. But we're all much more gastronomically aware than we used to be, and it has a lot to do with food-based TV programming and food media. I mean, Bobby Flay was on Entourage or some...
Yeah, he was
as himself.
Yeah, I know.
Popular culture. My brother, who is much younger than I am, knows what yuzu is. Knows what Great Northern beans are. Knows, you know, like all these obscure food things. We're much more in tune to them and much more aware of them, and they've really crossed over into popular culture. So with that, I think, is this awareness of things bitter and the complexity that bitter brings to food or to drink and what it does to your palate. And it's super refreshing for me to know that it's happening, because it means that we can, I can, in my cocktails and in the things I do, I can push the envelope even
right.
You've
got all these new crayons to play with. The same thing with acidity in wine that people are finally appreciating and tolerating.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what works with food, and this is why.
Yeah.
Get over it. It's great.
My business partner, you know, we'll be training staff members, and he's like, it's super zippy, super racy. And I remember a couple of years ago thinking to myself, really? Like, can you find a different word for that? You know, do we have to? But now it's everywhere. Everybody's like, oh man, that's so zippy. I'm like, yeah, and people are acid heads. It's great. It's awesome.
Ted Cardigy, thanks for coming in. The drink was Averna we were talking about, among other bitters. He's the co-founder of Tippling Brothers, both Window in the World graduates. My next guests are here. We'll bring him in the studio, get him on the microphone. There was a little traffic issue, but that's New York, and we're all good. Thank you so much for coming
Michael,
in.
Thank you, my friend.
$5 from everyone to deliver 100 meals. And it was supposed to be a one-time thing. She raised $35,000. She called the city, the Department for the Aging, and said, we're doing Christmas. And here we are, 33 years later, having delivered nearly 50 million meals.
It's, I mean, we're all guilty of this in our business. I mean, Manhattan is this tale of more than two cities for sure, but you know, my idea of a bad day is a workout that didn't go too well in the pool and a disappointing tasting menu at night or some horse shit, you know, white people problems. And yet I live in a neighborhood now, Lower East Side, And there's a lot of old people around, man. And I just, and I know some of the neighbors in my building, you know, these single women, a lot of them whose husbands predeceased them. And, you know, they're out of their apartment once a day with their walker. So talk about what you guys do day to day. How many people are you feeding? Because this is remarkable, the outreach.
It is remarkable. And actually, the people you're talking about are exactly the people we're serving, except those who can't get out, those who whose neighbors don't see them anymore. We're feeding 18,000 people in every borough of the city, about 2 million meals a year. And we rally, and we have 30 meal centers around the city. We rally volunteers, upwards of 12,000 a year, to help us do what we do. And these are people that are hidden, forgotten.
Yeah, right. Sadly true. I mean, we don't value elderly people in our society much, and it's sad to think. I mean, I'm not getting any younger, but, you know, I look at some of these people, and I'm thinking, hey, pal, you're next. Everybody gets old, and at some point, the kids are gone, and the interest level's out, and, you know, there's just not much for them to look forward to. So it's an incredible amount of outreach. Where's the funding come from?
Privately funded. We raise about $19 million a year. We get a small grant from the city for about 10% of our budget, and we really rely on the generosity of everyday New Yorkers to help us do what we do.
That gala that's coming up, that's going to be part of some of the funding has to come from that. Talk a little bit about that, when it is, who's involved, where it is, how people can sign up.
The event is our annual chef's tribute to City Meals on Wheels. This year, the theme is Summer by the Sea, so everyone will be cooking their dishes inspired by their summers past. It is 1,000 guests or so at Rockefeller Center. Mm-hmm. We have nearly 50 chefs, of course, Alfred being one of them, one of our founding chefs.
Right.
And it raises nearly $1 million for City Meals.
That one day, that one night.
The one night.
Wow.
And I want you to know, as with all our events and all our fundraising, 100% of ticket sales, of donations from the general public, go to meals. We're able to leverage our board members' donations for administrative costs. So every penny that people are donating can go to meals. And
how do they get tickets? How does it work?
Citymeals.org.
Okay.
You can go online, buy tickets, or call the office if you want.
Gotcha. Alfred, congratulations. 30 years at Gotham.
Thank you, Mike.
I mean, damn.
Yeah.
Where'd that time go? You and I were cooking school together. I think you graduated a couple of months before me. I remember your face from then. I remember you drove in an Alfa Romeo convertible. And I was like, damn, who is this pimp, man? I'm an RA in A dorm driving a blue Ford Pinto with Philadelphia tags.
I had a rich girlfriend.
Well, we'll fast, but great resume, great story. And you have been, I mean, Gotham Bar and Grill has been a staple in New York really since you got there. It wasn't the opening. We're not going to name names anymore, but it was Jerome Kretschmer, who worked for the Lindsay administration, decided he wanted to get into the restaurant business, had this wonderful space on 12th Street, kind of a prescient of him, this big loft-like room. But there was no chef. There was a consultant, as I recall, who was the acting chef.
Barbara Kafka.
Oh, I wasn't going to name her. Anyway, okay, so you're not listening. Barbara Kafka, the plates were black, the theme was vaguely Mediterranean and Moroccan, and it sucked. He knew it, and he asked around, and the community was so much smaller then, right? I mean, if you think about the restaurant world.
It really was.
Was it Jonathan Waxman that suggested you?
Yes, exactly. Jonathan had just opened Jams. The woman I was with at the time was Jonathan's chef, and through Jonathan, and I got to know Larry Forgione, and Jonathan told me that they were looking for a chef there.
And you had been CIA grad, and you'd spent some time in France with Michel Girard?
Yeah, Girard, Toigreau, and Maxime.
Well, great. I mean, Jacques Maxime was a rock star back in the...
He was.
In the Negresco then?
Yes.
And Toigreau's, you know, generational in Rouen, just an astonishing kitchen.
Yeah.
So you've got this wonderful pedigree. You come back, you get that leash to run with, completely turn the kitchen around. And in relatively short order, and this is the Gail Green story, as I recall it, too, Gail was just a huge fan right away.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, Gail has been a very dear friend. I think she had tried to convince Kretschmer to let her host a big fundraiser at Gotham, but I was only there for a couple of weeks, so I was not allowed to cook a dish. I basically sort of coordinated and hosted and, you know, the event. But we had We had some amazing chefs there. And, you know, in thinking about it, she was, Jerry said, you know, Gail, come in for lunch. And because I think this guy is really good. He's already changed the butter.
So. Which, no, but back then that was a big deal. I don't know what you went from and to, but you changed the butter.
So she came in and, she, you know, just knocked her socks off. So I think 5 months or 6 months in, she gave us a great review in New York Magazine. And, you know, we haven't looked back since.
Well, we'll put a finer point on that. Haven't looked back since means in a span of 3 decades and, oh, a half a dozen or more critics of record at the New York Magazine, which is the paper of record in the city that matters. 3 stars uninterrupted.
Yeah. New York Times.
Excuse me. That's what I meant. New York Times. Yeah. Every critic from the Times, from the first review to your very last one, it's been a 3-star. That's a hell of a long run. That's fantastic.
Yeah, we're very proud. We've got 5 reviews, 5 3-star reviews, and the last coming, I think it was last year or maybe the year before, not long ago. We're very proud.
Great. And you haven't, and unlike a lot of chefs that, you know, you've resisted the temptation to open up Gotham's in Las Vegas, Gotham's in 16 hotels, Gotham's Dubai.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure if Michael White could take a page from the Alfred Portales stay in New York thing, but Michael's following his own tune.
Well, Michael must not value his personal time.
Well, congratulations on everything. So, and you're still in town to this day, but you've been involved with City Meals on Wheels since then.
You know, I wasn't there the first year. I was brought on the second year because I had just started at Gotham and it was too new. But it was Jonathan and Larry whose idea, I think they approached Gail with this idea to honor Jim.
That's right, because he was supposed to have been the first one in past.
Yeah,
it
was such an honor to be part of that group. There were maybe 13 or 14 founding chefs. And it stayed that way for many, many years. With, you know, we'd invite a few guest chefs in. You know, it's opened up quite a bit now. But I mean, working with Jeremiah Tower and Wolfgang Puck and Alice Waters and Paul Prudhomme was buzzing around in his wheelchair. It was an honor and a thrill to be part of it. And City Meals on Wheels sort of holds a special place in my heart because my parents have passed. When they retired, my dad retired at 60 years old. Both of them, and they're up upstate New York now in Buffalo. They volunteered 3-4 days a week of their time for the local chapter of Meals on Wheels. My mother used to help pack the meals, and my father did administrative work. So, and the fact that, you know, not only does every penny that's donated go to the charity, what's so remarkable is if they have signage, you know, in the event, the sign company donates it. You know, if they have, you know, whatever rentals they have, they donate. It's just a remarkable charity in that way. And I'm very proud to be a part of it.
Beth, talk about the logistics of running this day to day, if you don't mind, because I'm just curious. It's, as an ex-restaurant guy, it's hard enough to open up the door in the morning, open up the walk-in box, and feed 125 people well with a brigade of line cooks that knows what they're doing and someone on the pass. How on earth do you coordinate all of this food, get it packaged, and get it out to people?
Well, we're very lucky to partner with the city because we leverage their relationships at meal centers throughout the city. So as I said, we have 30 meal centers that we contract with. And basically, they run independently. So they're buying on their own. They're cooking, prepping, getting meals out the door. And we're funding them to stay open when they would normally close. We have a small staff. We have 22 people who work incredibly hard to do what they do, to coordinate with the centers, to coordinate our volunteers, to raise money to do what we do. We have had a profound impact in the city in the last couple of years with emergencies.
Yeah, we haven't had we've had our share.
We've had our share. Yeah. With Hurricane Sandy, yeah, we truly became the city's arm for getting meals to older New Yorkers. We delivered over 64,000 emergency meals with over 800 volunteers in the days leading up to the hurricane and the couple weeks after. This winter.
And a lot of that would have been schlepping stuff upstairs because elevators were gone for 10 days south of 14th Street or
absolutely
34th, wherever the line was. I was out of town.
It's why we needed so many volunteers, because you can't give someone a 5-pound box of food that's going to last an older person a couple of days and expect that they're going to carry 20 of them up 17 flights of stairs or more. And we enlisted our board members, our volunteers, our staff. Everyone we could was out delivering. This year, with all the snow.
I was going to say, this was an epic winter. This was one. I'm an out and about active guy, and I never do this. And there must have been a half a dozen, 10 nights this winter when I just came home at 6 o'clock and said, fuck this. I'm tired of walking into a 60-mile-an-hour, two-degree north wind and getting my ass. I got a kitchen. I know how to cook. F it. I got wine. I got food. I'm staying in. Even, I never do that.
Even your neighbors, your older female neighbors who have their walkers who might be able to get to the store on the weekend, you know, on the corner, not this winter.
Right.
175,000 emergency meals that we delivered this winter.
Wow. Incredible. Incredible. Incredible work. So one more time, give us a shout out if people are interested, because this is, you know, I've had guys in here and I've volunteered at some of the New York shelters. The downtown shelter has been the one on Lafayette Street. It's been sort of near and dear to me. And we sit on these programs like ours and we talk for endless hours about bitters and wines and terroir and food. And there's another half to the city that is homeless, that doesn't eat, single moms raising kids that cannot get through the month, and of course the elderly that are almost invisible because to the people you're taking care of are literally housebound older people. So if someone wanted to go to the event, they go to what website again? And how's it work? What's the $250, $300, how's it work for the tasting thing?
It's citymeals.org.
Citymeals.org, that's easy.
Easy. The event is actually...
And when is it? It's June what?
June 9th.
Okay.
Monday, June 9th.
Okay.
VIP admissions at 6:30, general admission at 7:30. Tickets for general admission are $600. There's actually... I hope, Gail, don't kill me if you're listening. There's a GG, a Gail Green special. So if they go in and see a promo code that they can put in CMOW, City Meals on Wheels, GG, for a 20% discount on the tickets.
Gotcha. Great. And these every year they do well. Every year they sell it. Every year you've got a great
time. We do phenomenal because we have amazing chefs like Alfred who come and give so generously of their time and their art. And I feel like, you know, they're feeding people every day from their hearts, and it's just taking it one step further. And not every day does a New Yorker have a chance to not only get the food that Alfred's cooking, but he's handing it right to them.
Yeah, I've been to a couple
event.
Of them over the years. It's pretty amazing. Everybody's involved, and the generosity is evident. Alfred, if you don't mind, let's just go back to Gotham a bit, because I think one of the things you were also a hallmark of the early days at Gotham, a really important restaurant of all the eras, but of course that was a different time in New York City. It was a smaller town, and there was maybe a restaurant or two. You know, when Montrachet opened, it was the opening. When Danny opened Union Square, it was the opening. Gotham was one. Bernadette a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that was interesting about your food that differentiated itself, besides the French technique and the great, you know, ingredients have gotten so much better, but great sourcing of ingredients, was that idea of visual design. I mean, the idea of building up plates that were vertical. You know, everyone else was sort of flat, and Rachou had the dots and the schmear. I mean, we kind of remember those eras of pulled sauces, and we laughed, but we did it, and it was cool as hell at the time. But you kind of brought food up off of the plate, and something to this day that's had great effect on how people plate. Where'd that idea come from?
Oh, okay. There were several reasons for it. The first, the underlying reason is that as a young chef, I was fortunate enough to cook with, you know, three of the greatest chefs in the world, who I learned a great deal from. I spent 2 years at the Culinary Institute, as you did. But, you know, rather than try to just do food that was derivative of my mentors, I was consciously driven to create my own style. I wanted my own style. And then you add to that, I have a long-standing, you know, I studied art and jewelry design and sculpture ever since I was like 9 years old. By no means am I a fine artist, but I had that sensibility of design. And also, you know, craftsmanship. You know, I'm currently make fine furniture. So I love the whole craftsman, you know, aspect to it. So you add all that together. I was at 18 or 19 years old, I became interested in the Japanese art of miniature trees, bonsai. And, you know, studied it as and understood it as well as any, you know, 18-year-old American
could.
It's a
funny thing to get into at 18. I think at 18 I was thinking about was drugs and girls.
Yeah, well, yeah. That was that too, but
well, bonsai, dude.
So you kind of add it all together. And then you add in the fact that, you know, I've worked in France where we had 30 cooks for cooking 60 dinners.
I know.
And that was the kind of food I wanted to do. I really wanted like some very intricate and high touch food, but I had to figure out how to do it for 160 seats and 300 covers. So I engineered the food basically so that I could do it with great speed without sacrificing any of the flavor or quality. And everything was highly engineered so that every plate looked the same. Because
right.
It would be easy for me to plate something and make it look gorgeous.
But for a photograph, but how do we do that 32 times a night for every customer?
You know, that and, you know, just realizing, like, food in nature, you know, I mean, that's not how my garden looks. It's not flat. I mean, things grow up. They have dimension. And they have different levels. So I started to work with just different heights, never trying to make something necessarily tall, but it started with some gentle stacking and you're getting a couple of different elevations that, you know, creating consistency in the presentation and the preparation and speed in other ways. So that's how it all came about.
And to your point, I think one of those of us that were lucky enough to have had a chance in the 80s to stage in Europe or to work in Europe, and I got to work with Alan Sanderins at Orchestrat, and every summer traveled and ate, you know, would be an homage, would be to go spend what little money we had to the cook's wages, but we would go, my girlfriend or wife and I would go and travel, you know, one day it was Vonnaz, 2 days later it was Rouen, then it was Robuchon and Germain and Vézelay, and you'd go back to your hotel room and draw pictures of the plates. But the disconnect between what was taking place in Europe was the one that you made quite well. I mean, at Orchestrat, we had 18, 20 guys in the kitchen, and we were feeding 35 people. That was it. One seating for dinner.
Yeah.
And then you came back to the States, and it was like, how do I replicate the quality that I want, that flavor, that accuracy? But now suddenly your dining room is 101?
It's 160 seats.
Yeah, it's a completely different paradigm. I mean, you're going to turn that room 2 to 3 times a night.
I mean, I left the restaurant a few hours ago, and we had 280 reservations for tonight. So.
Gotham is a go-to restaurant for everybody.
Yeah.
And you'll get a bunch of walk-ins. So that 280, you'll become 320, I'm sure.
Well, you got to take out the 15% no-show rate.
Is that still happen? Does that still happen?
Sure.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, less so. You know, the job, I think restaurants are doing a much better job with confirmations, and they confirm a couple of days in advance, and they're all kind of, it's a different world, but you have to watch it.
Well, congratulations. It's a great run.
Thank you.
It's really, really a great run.
Thank you.
And he's got a great tennis game, too, I'm told.
Wow. Yeah, you did your research.
I did my research. I talked to my peeps.
Yes.
So back to the meals. So it's June. Give me the date again.
Monday, June 9th.
Website is?
Citymeals.org.
One of the great causes. So if you listen to this show, you know I talk about a lot of the politics of food beyond the scope of the fact that, yes, we're all foodies and we love it and we're lucky and we live in New York and it's the greatest restaurant city in the world. But for a bunch of New Yorkers that are either homeless and poor, which we've talked about on this program, or working poor, which is really a big epidemic in the city as well, today we're discussing the really shut-ins, the sort of forgotten members of society that really nobody, I mean, that I feel guilty saying this too, that little neighbor on your floor that you know probably gets out once a day, if that. Great cause. So go to your website one more time, give it a shout out.
Citymeals.org.
Citymeals.org. Go to that night. You get to meet a whole bunch of great chefs. You can, maybe if you're lucky, you'll get a selfie of you and Alfred if he lets that happen. Folks, you're listening to Michael Michael's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. We've got to call it quits. It's been an hour and change. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week for more.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.